Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
All right, let's jump right in. Today we're hitting the road, quite literally, with Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Such a huge book, came out in 1957, and it wasn't just, you know, another novel. It really felt like a lightning strike for the culture. It basically became the defining text for the Beat Generation.
Absolutely, and you really have to understand the time to get why it landed so powerfully. Think about post-World War II America. On the surface, yeah, there's prosperity, the suburbs are booming.
Mm.
But underneath, a lot of people felt this stifling conformity, like a pressure cooker.
Right, the whole gray flannel suit thing.
Exactly. And Kerouac, well, his background was different. French-Canadian roots, a sort of mix of Catholic upbringing and later this deep spiritual seeking, but also very earthy. He tapped into that feeling of being trapped, that yearning for something, something real, authentic.
So that's our plan for today. We're going to follow that yearning. We'll dig into the writing style itself, which was revolutionary. We'll look at the core relationships, Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty, which is complicated, to say the least, tragic even, and then grapple with those big themes, freedom, disillusionment, what it all means.
And you have to start with the style because, honestly, the way it's written is the message in so many ways.
Yeah.
Kerouac called it spontaneous prose. The idea was, writing as fast as you think. No censoring, no second guessing.
Like a direct line from the mind to the page.
Pretty much. He wanted that immediacy, that raw energy. He was hugely influenced by music, especially bebop jazz, you know, the rhythms, the improvisation.
Yeah, you can almost hear it when you read it. And then there's the legend of how it was written, the scrawl.
That famous three-week writing binge mm-hmm. in 1951. Apparently, he taped together sheets of teletype paper into this, like, 120-foot-long roll, just fed it into the typewriter and went, fueled by coffee, just pouring it all out. It was almost like a performance piece itself.
Yeah.
Trying to capture the speed and chaos of the experiences themselves.
Exactly. And it ties into this idea of first thought, best thought. It wasn't just about speed. It was philosophical. There was this growing interest in Zen Buddhism, this idea of getting past the analytical mind to some kind of pure, momentary truth, like a flash of insight.
But okay, let's pause there. Because that style, it wasn't universally loved. Right, especially not at first.
Oh, definitely not. You had some critics like Gilbert Millin who immediately saw it as something major, a historic occasion, I think he called it. But a lot of the literary establishment, they were just baffled or even hostile.
They found it messy, unstructured.
Yeah, undisciplined, maybe amoral characters, breaking all the rules of grammar and punctuation. The big question then, and maybe still now, is where's the line between spontaneous and just chaotic.
Does the immediacy sometimes just become noise?
It's a valid point. But I think the novel's power comes from committing to that chaos. It's not trying to be neat. It's trying to make you feel the rush, the confusion, the energy. You kind of have to surrender to it, like you're in the car with them. The form fits the function, you could say.
Okay, so let's get in the car then. Let's talk about the people driving this thing. We start with Sal Paradise. He's the narrator, basically Kerouac's alter ego.
Right, Sal's the writer, the observer. He starts out feeling stuck. He's in New Jersey, recovering from a divorce, some illness, just feeling stagnant, like life is passing him by. He's looking for something more vital.
And that something more vital arrives in the form of Dean Moriarty.
Oh, yeah. Dean, based on Kerouac's real-life friend Neil Cassady, Dean is just electric. He bursts onto the scene. He's this fast-talking, charismatic, reckless ex-con from Denver, the ultimate holy goof, as Sal calls him.
Oh, holy goof? What does that even mean?
It's that paradox.
Yeah. Right?
He embodies this incredible, raw, instinctual freedom, like pure energy. But he's also incredibly destructive, totally unconventional, almost amoral in his actions.
And Sal is completely drawn to him, obsessed almost. Why? What does Sal see in Dean?
Sal sees Dean as, like, the key. A kind of spiritual guide, maybe. Mm-hmm. Someone who lives the intensity that Sal only dreams of writing about. Dean is the raw material for Sal's art, the embodiment of this authentic American energy Sal feels he's lost.
Okay, so Sal gets inspiration, material. What's in it for Dean? It feels very transactional in a way.
That's a good word for it. Well, Dean needs Sal too. He needs an audience, an appreciative one. Sal is the intellectual who can sort of frame Dean's chaos, validate his ramblings, make his manic energy seem profound, like a quest. Without Sal watching and writing, Dean might just be, well, a burnout.
A fast car heading nowhere, as you said. And what are they actually looking for on these endless trips? They call it IT. Can we pin that down?
IT, yeah. That's the elusive thing. It's that peak experience, that moment of of transcendence, I guess. Mm. Pure understanding, pure feeling, total immersion. They find glimpses of it in jazz, in the speed of the car, sometimes in intense conversations, or even just the landscape flying by.
So it's like an existential quest for ecstasy, authenticity.
Both, I think. It's about breaking through the surface of ordinary life, society's expectations, to touch something real, something profound, almost like a religious experience, but found on the road, in the moment. A very American kind of transcendentalism, maybe.
And the book's structure reflects that search, right? It's not a neat plot. It jumps around.
Exactly. It's picaresque, episodic, just like the trips themselves. Five parts covering these cross-country journeys between roughly 1947 and 1950. It wanders.
So walk us through those parts. Part one sets the initial tone.
Yeah, part one, starting around 47. This is Sal's first big solo trip west, mostly hitchhiking. There's a sense of wonder, hopeful discovery. He meets all sorts of people, eventually hooks up with Dean. And there's that brief, almost sweet romance with Terry, the Mexican-American woman he meets working in the cotton fields in California.
A moment of connection of something potentially stable.
Exactly. It's this glimpse of a different kind of life, grounded, connected to the earth. But it doesn't last. Sal gets restless. Dean calls. The road pulls him back. That cycle starts right away. Movement, brief connection, then back to the motion.
Okay, so part two. Things start to get a bit darker.
Definitely. This is a couple of years later, maybe 1949. Dean's manic energy is really on display now, and you start seeing the tracks. They drive down to New Orleans to see Old Bull Lee, who is basically William S. Burroughs. The atmosphere is heavier, more drugs, more intensity. And then out in San Francisco, you see Dean trying to juggle his life, his wife Camille, his other girlfriend Mary Lou. The consequences of his freedom are becoming clearer.
And this is where the criticism about the treatment of women often comes up, right?
Yes, and it's crucial to acknowledge. The women in the novel are often, well, secondary. They exist in relation to the men's quest. They're anchors Dean pulls against or people left behind picking up the pieces. His search for IT also seems to depend on their stability being shattered. It's a really problematic aspect of the book for modern readers.
Understood. So the energy keeps building. What happens in part three?
Part three is probably the most intense, the most frantic section. Another wild cross-country drive, New York to Denver, then SF. Lots of benzodrine, nonstop talking, driving like maniacs. Sal is pushed to his absolute limit, physically and mentally, but the real gut punch is emotional.
This is the big betrayal.
Yeah. The trip climaxes with Dean just ditching Sal in San Francisco. Sal's broke, sick, completely alone. It's a cold move. And it forces Sal to finally see Dean not as some kind of hero or guru, but as someone capable of profound selfishness. The romantic image starts to crack badly.
So the idol has feet of clay. What about the final trip, part four?
Part four, they head south. To Mexico in 1950, they're looking for something even more raw, more primal, maybe trying to escape America altogether. But it ends in disaster. Sal gets incredibly sick with dysentery, just completely laid out, feverish, vulnerable in this cheap Mexican hotel.
And Dean
leaves him. Again, says he's too restless, can't handle sitting still, got to keep moving. He just takes off. It's brutal. And for Sal, that's really the end of the illusion. It's not just Dean being flawed. It's the whole quest built on that kind of motion revealed as empty, maybe, or just pathologically avoidant.
Wow, that's a low point. How does it resolve? Part five.
Part five is the epilogue, really. Sal is back in New York. He's found a measure of peace, stability. He's writing the book, this book. He's channeling the chaos into art. And Dean shows up one last time. But the magic is gone. He's described as pathetic, shivering, a ragged ghost. He's lost. Sal watches him go, but chooses not to follow this time. He chooses his new stability, his creative work, over getting pulled back into Dean's destructive energy.
So Sal finds a different kind of IT in creation, maybe.
You could definitely read it that way. So reflecting back on the whole journey, what's the big takeaway? It seems to circle around this tension between freedom and its cost.
Yeah, the road is the ultimate symbol of escape, right? Escaping that 1950s conformity. But the novel seems to ask, okay, what kind of freedom is this? Is Dean's absolute liberty actually liberating, or is it just another trap, chaos?
Exactly. Is it freedom, or is it just an inability to connect, to be responsible? And it's not just a cost to Dean himself, but to everyone around him, especially the women and children left in his wake.
And there's that theme about the American West, too. They're chasing this idea of a new frontier, not just geographically, but a frontier of consciousness.
Right, like modern pioneers.
Yeah.
But what do they actually find out there? Often it's loneliness, poverty, breakdown. There's this huge gap between the dream of the West, the American dream even, and the messy reality they encounter. The spiritual frontier remains elusive.
Which maybe leads into that famous quote, the Mad Ones passage. It feels like the heart of the book's appeal, especially for young readers.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly poetic and captures that yearning for intensity. You want to read it?
Yeah, let me find it. Here. The only people for me are the mad ones. The ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time. The ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the star.
It gives you chills, right? It's so evocative.
Yeah.
But think about the image. Roman candles, they burn incredibly bright, spectacularly.
Yeah.
And then they're gone. Instantly.
So it's beautiful, but inherently self-destructive.
I think that's the undercurrent. It's intoxicating, that desire for everything all at once. But the novel shows you the burnout. It shows you Dean at the end. That intensity is unsustainable. It carries a deep melancholy.
And that melancholy comes through in other lines, too, quieter ones, like the one about driving away from people.
Ah, yeah. What is that feeling when you're driving away from people and they recede on the plane till you see their specks dispersing? It's the two huge world vaulting us and it's goodbye. There's such sadness in that constant motion, that constant leaving.
So, wrapping up, why does this book still resonate so strongly after all these decades?
Well, I think it captures something timeless about youth, doesn't it? That desperate search for meaning, for experience, the thrill of rebellion, the sheer energy of it. But it doesn't just glorify the rebellion. It forces you eventually to confront the cost. It makes you weigh that desire for absolute freedom against the need for connection, for responsibility, maybe even for the quiet work of creation, like Sal finds.
So it's not just a time capsule of the Beats. It asks enduring questions about how to live, how to balance that burning intensity with, well, with being human in the world with others. Finding freedom that isn't just chaos.
Exactly. It makes the chaos seem incredibly alluring, but ultimately suggests that real fulfillment might lie somewhere else. Passion, yes, but maybe accountability, too.
A powerful tension to leave us with.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.